I found that absolutely fascinating, and particularly some of the names that you mentioned. I mean, the Holberry Society I'd heard of, the Bill Moore I spoke to on the phone several times, and met him on his 90th birthday. And there are others, you know, that you didn't mention, but as inevitably there was going to be. Anyway, now it's your turn. Please indicate by sticking your hand up in a way that I can see, and I will try to be as equitable as I can. But it's not all that easy to see in all of you. So who would like to make a contribution?
Hello. Thank you. I understand that there are so many others. You spoke about the carpenter and working men setting up the Sheffield Socialist Society. Looking at the photograph, I assume that the women in the picture were not hangers-on. Are you able to tell us anything about the women's involvement in the Sheffield Socialist Society?
I think I'm trying to remember, really. I think the women were certainly involved, and Carpenter was certainly the sort of person who would encourage women to express their views and come out with their own insights. And I mean, it was a male-dominated period, but I think the women would have been quite reasonably important, but not in the lead at that time.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm a member of the Unitarian Church at Clare Chapel, and I'd like to say that some of us are still as radical as it was then.
Glad to hear it.
I was wondering to what extent the British Empire had an impact on politics in Sheffield, kind of going through the rise of the Empire, and was there much of a history of opposition to imperialism that you came across in your studies?
I fear it's the story is probably more the other way round, that particularly from the time of the Crimean War onwards, imperialism was quite a strong force in Sheffield as in the rest of the country. But going a little earlier, the anti-slavery movement was very strong in Sheffield. Gales, who I talked about, and Montgomery were very strongly for the anti-slavery movement. I think there was a ban on sugar in the Gales household in the 1790s for this reason. I'm sure that as socialist ideas developed, there would have been more and more questioning of imperialism. There was a great liberal MP called H.J. Wilson, and he probably was one of the more impressive sort of anti-imperialists. I mean, he campaigned against the Boer War, and I think people threw stones at his house as a result. And he attacked the opium trade in India. I don't know whether you know, but we had a lovely trade providing opium from India to China in the late 19th century.
Gentlemen, the back of it.
Is the present political situation in South Yorkshire as a result of the triumph of consumerism over social and economic justice?
would it help if we didn't pose that as a question to the speaker, but put threw it into the discussion generally for others to comment on.
I think that might be better.
Dave.
I hail from Bristol originally, and of course the 1832 Reform Bill led to the burning down of substantial areas. There are a lot of angry people down there. You didn't mention much around the 1832 events, only the later ones. Was there much in Sheffield at that time?
Yes, there was a body called the Sheffield Political Union, and it was an uneasy alliance between the middle class and the working class. Held together by one of my favourite Sheffield characters called Thomas Asline Ward, who was master cutler at one time, who was a very sincere liberal, very supportive of the working class. And he stood for Parliament after the Parliamentary Reform Act had been carried through. He stood for Parliament, one of, I think, four candidates, and the very small number of electors, 3,000 odd, didn't vote him in. And he was so popular with the working class that there were then riots, and several people were shot by the troops as a result of the riots. And the establishment in Sheffield tried to hush this up because they thought it was so embarrassing for the town. But there was nothing remotely on the scale of the Bristol riots, but the big riot was really after the election result was announced.
Yes, the lady with the red.
I live in Birkendale, which is one of the land society development areas, which I think happened in the 1840s. And I'm wondering if some of the idea behind this was to promote the radical vote by giving people land and therefore by giving them a vote.
Yes, it's interesting. I think it came as a shock to people when to the middle class liberals and so on, when Ironside managed to get as many votes as he did for his Democrats, and he was, there were I can't remember the detail of the franchise arrangements, but they did allow small holders to get the vote, and so there might be something in what you say, but I think there was a wider something a bit wider going on. I imagine, do your houses have reasonably large gardens?
Or, yes, I think each plot was an acre, and the idea was to give people land, so it wouldn't entirely have been for the vote, but I just wonder if there's another motivation behind it.
It might be, but I think there was also a big movement in the 1840s. There was a sense that industrialism was failing because so many people were unemployed and there was such distress, and so people were looking at going back to agriculture in a way. It was at that time that the workhouse, the Poor Law Guardians, introduced an experiment at Hollow Meadows to have people, instead of breaking up oakum, they actually had a farm at Hollow Meadows for paupers, as they were called, to work. So it was a period when people were thinking about going back to the land.
I can always add something.
Peggy.
It has been often said that most revolutions are started not by the working class but by the middle class. Your talk tonight seems to contradict that. Or is that so?
That's very interesting. I mean, I think it is really both, isn't it? If you take the two periods I talked about most, which were the 1790s and the 1840s, in the 1790s, Joseph Gales was a clearly a middle-class editor who took up the cause, what was really a revolutionary cause. So I don't know whether he realised it was revolutionary, but it was really, it was certainly in the eyes of the establishment, it was. In the Chartist period, I think you could say that was a period of genuine working-class leadership, and Samuel Holbury would certainly have regarded himself as working-class, and the people around him were. Isaac Ironside came from working class origins, and the fact that he was an accountant seemed to seem not to change his attitudes really. He remained very much a working class advocate. I don't know, I'd have to think about your question.
Harry.
It's interesting that a lot of the agitation, shall we say, in the 19th century comes from a working class who were involved in small firms and craftsmen. Whereas, under Marxist analysis, you would have thought it would have been in the much larger firms that this would have operated. And there were large operations that had taken place in the coal industry. Both to the north and the south of here. Yet, in the 19th century, because there were so many of them and they started to acquire the vote, a great number of them were involved with liberalism, the sort of left wing of the Liberal Party, rather than the idea of Keir Hardie was to form a separate Labour Party and to have some socialist ideas associated with it. So, it might be that Sheffield illustrates that it isn't necessarily the large industrial complex that leads to that situation, but a mixture of different circumstances in which a small firm, people who communicate readily with each other, maybe are open to the possibilities of agitation.
Yeah. I think there was a sea change in Sheffield around 1850 industrially, so that after 1850 you start getting these massive steelworks in the east end of the town, and then gradually trade unionism starts to develop in those very big factories. But the old craft setup is still there, and the famous outrages, which were in 1868, Broadhead and Co., were an expression of the old-fashioned craft sort of movement. Rather destructive, really. It wasn't creating a new Jerusalem at all. It was a kind of very reactive, defensive sort of trade unionism. But I think before 1850 there weren't the large, big, huge companies like you got in Manchester. Very much there were a few, but they weren't they weren't a big factor, and sort of Marx's analysis didn't really apply. But you've asked a very important question.
Yes, you. Oh, it's Gordon, I'm sorry.
Yes,
down there, I couldn't recognise
it. James Montgomery, you mentioned, it's quite interesting. I wrote a piece about James Montgomery and the Sheffield Interfaith newsletter, and I read a story that James Montgomery, when he was in a religious private school in North Yorkshire, I think, secretly read Robert Burns' poems. Mm. I don't know if you know any more about that connection, but he was obviously very much against the slave trade and wrote his poems about that. Do you know any connection between him and Robert Burns's rhymes?
Well, I mean, what you say is extremely likely, because Montgomery came from a Moravian background. Moravians are a small Christian sect from presumably Moravia in Europe, but they had a boarding school, I think it was called Fulbrook, which he was at. And he was a very precocious, literary young man, and so he would have read all the poets that there were. And if Robert Burns' poems were around, he would have read them, I expect. Because he's in his mid to late teens. I mean, he was desperate to become a poet. And there's a wonderful story of him accosting the Earl Fitzwilliam and saying, "Will you read my poem?" And the Earl Fitzwilliam, slightly taken aback, but I think gave him a sovereign or something. he was attacked by the Edinburgh Review, and he was very sad about that when he was a poet in the early 19th century, and Byron sort of wrote to his defence, in his defence.
I think we've got an incipient revolution. The last three speakers, including the next one, are all off the back row. Now, I'm prepared to receive offers from forward. That's sprung a few up. Steve?
Trying to read into what the contribution that you've made, and trying to put it all together, it seems as though I'm looking on history now, and humanity as a whole is trying to actually get out of the excesses of capitalism, and listening to, or being pointed out, some of these radicals and what have you. I mean, I've never read any of them, and I won't know where they stand politically, but I'm assuming that some of them will be like philanthropic capitalists as such, wanting to get rid of the excesses of capitalism, and some will be socialists. And as we know, there's different sorts of socialists, some that no idea how to get to socialism, some that what you might interpret as extreme, but the general sort of contribution, or that historic period, is humanity itself is actually trying to get out of capitalism, or trying to give capitalism some human face, and yes, it's just human history. To quote Marx, it's the two history has been the history of class struggle, and as you can see from what you've been from the contribution all the way through it, even capitalists are struggling against their own class, in a sense, to try and make it a bit more philanthropic. Just a slight aside, where I can, because I went on that demonstration when Margaret Thatcher came, we talk about the Socialist Republic of South Yorkshire, but it made me laugh on the day, because they arrested Roger Barton. MEP, and I thought, yes, it's a socialist republic in South Yorkshire, maybe, but they still haven't got state power yet.
Yes.
Dan?
Just a few comments, perhaps, just add on some of the things you've been saying. I think, first of all, you should be congratulated on a very interesting book. And I don't at all regret that I bought it full price rather than waiting. it's interesting, perhaps in the context of some of the things the other people have been saying, that a lot of the troublemakers you were talking about actually spent a lot of their time calming crowds and stopping people rioting, which is interesting. But just a few memories that were sparked in me. You were talking about the monolith at the top of Fargate, which was a very big centre for speakers, as you said. So Fulton Carpenter spoke there. And I'm particularly interested in what's called the infidel radical tradition, going back to Paine and so forth, and the Hall of Science and all that kind of thing. And the monolith is where a lot of these people spoke and were violently attacked by Christian groups and things like that. And so there's an interesting disjunction between the fact that a lot of the people you're talking about have almost religious backgrounds, Unitarian backgrounds, dissident religious backgrounds, and the fact you also have people from very non-religious or anti-religious backgrounds involved in the same kind of thing, and that perhaps that disunites progressive forces in some way. And the other thing I was reminded of was the Hall of Science was where George Jacob Holyoake was posted as a lecturer for the Owenite movement.
That's right, yeah.
When he took over the editorship of the Oracle of Reason, the first atheist magazine to be published in the UK, after Southwell was arrested for fairly blatant blasphemy, and then Holyoake himself was then arrested for comments made in the speech and locked up for that as well. So there's a big connection between Sheffield and the early atheism. And then, of course, Bradlaugh, Charles Bradlaugh, the later became MP for Northampton, radical liberal rather than socialist, and anti-socialist, in fact. But he based the National Reformer, his magazine, in Sheffield in the early days. So it's quite interesting that you see two different traditions, a kind of radical religious tradition and a kind of the radical infidel tradition at the same time. And I wonder to what extent that weakens some of the progress that presumably both sides wanted to see. And you get mixed up in arguments around whether or not there's a God, when actually that might be a minor part of what the real issues are.
It's very interesting, yeah. A lot of the impetus of radical movements came from people who'd certainly been brought up as Christians and often had later... had doubts or given it up, and that was true, I think, of Joseph Poynter, the first Labour MP in Sheffield. But a historian who's done a lot of work on this, on the early Labour movement, says that this was a sort of pattern, really. But your question was whether people used up a lot of energy arguing amongst themselves about religion instead of getting on with whatever they're called, or something like that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting question, because as an atheist myself, I think the arguments are good to have, but sometimes it could drive a wedge between forces who are actually moving in similar directions sometimes.
Yes.
That's the point, I think.
Yes. I don't really know. I mean, you get an impression in the Victorian periods of huge arguments in all directions, including... between the religious people about when Father Omani went to St Matthew's Carl Street, and all the religious people were against him because he was too papist, and so you've got it on all sides. There was a didn't cover in my book, but is quite interesting. There was quite a strong disestablishment movement in Sheffield in the about the 1860s, 70s period for disestablishing the Church of England. It's another example. I suspect that there were very few atheists, actually. I mean, I've just read a biography of Thomas Paine, who's a bit much earlier, of course, and he was incredibly unpopular because of his book The Age of Reason, which was an anti-religious book. But he does seem to have been a deist to his death, you know. And that is true also of Joseph Priestley, who applied to become minister at Upper Chapel, but was turned down because he was too sort of lively and jumped over chairs and things like that. But a friend of mine has just written a new book about Priestley, which your group might find interesting, Keith Baker, on Joseph Priestley, Friends and Foes. And he's a local Sheffield author. And, of course, he was a towering figure, really, in the Unitarian movement and in science and kind of what you might call rational thought.
Mike.
Hi there. I've also bought the book at full price.
Oh, right.
I haven't read it yet.
Oh, right.
I gave it I gave it to a friend of mine because he reads the Daily Telegraph.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping to read it later. I'm also an incomer, so I quickly picked up in the 80s this idea that Sheffield had this radical history. I've never been entirely clear whether it was a fully justified reputation as compared with other major centres in the northeast or anything of that kind. But one of the clues that somebody said, well, if you want a clue to this, it's the barracks, the Hillsborough barracks.
Yeah.
And that it was felt that there was a need to establish that there at that time. And then sometime later I saw a plan of it, and there were all kinds of details in the design. It's very clear that it was designed to withstand siege. It had large tanks for storing water. I don't know whether your research or whether the book indeed touches on the role of the barracks and what it was that would have driven them to build something as substantial as that, whether they really felt that threatened by what was going on in Sheffield in particular, or whether it was more typical than I thought hitherto.
Well, the original barracks wasn't the Hillsborough one. I think the Hillsborough one was built around 1850, but the original barracks was nearer into town, in the same direction. I can't remember exactly where it was. Somebody may know. But what you say is very interesting. You see, I think
it's not the territorial ones, is it? It's not the territorial ones.
No, I don't think there's anything left of it.
That's the only other barracks.
No, it's anyway. I'll check.
Let's ponder it.
The point you make about the Hillsborough barracks being built to withstand a siege, well, that might fit in with the story I told you about Holbury's insurrection, because he was planning to set fire to the barracks, and that was one of the big targets that he had. It was magistrates' houses. The barracks and the police office were his big targets. So having it very... I've been to the college building in the Hillsborough barracks, and it is built like a castle. It's an amazingly strong stone building. So I think the fear of breakdown of law and order on the part of the authorities was huge. And we probably today... can't quite think ourselves into that state of mind, but they must have really been fearful that revolution would take hold. So,
and more so here than elsewhere.
I haven't done a comparative study of all the big towns. I mean, a lot of radical movements started in, were dominated by Manchester. Manchester was terribly important as well. Certainly, at certain periods, Sheffield was a pretty key radical place, and like the 1790s, and to some extent the Chartist period. But it was dominated by the Conservatives in the late Victorian period.
My question related to the last one, really. Listening to your talk, and I haven't read the book, it did seem as if there wasn't a lot of spontaneous combustion of troublemaking in Sheffield as opposed to being part of a national scene like the Chartist movement. And related to that is, how did these outside ideas and the knowledge of things like the Peterloo Massacre, how did they actually filter down to the mass of people who, were, after all, were not literate and wouldn't be reading the papers available at the day, presumably? How did they filter down so that a mass movement could start? Was it all oral tradition? You see, we heard about Bristol and lots of things in Manchester, of course, and other cities in the north. And moving barracks into industrial cities wasn't unusual at all, was it? It wasn't that Sheffield was highlighted as a particularly troublesome spot, surely.
Well, I think the anecdote... It depends what period you're talking about. The anecdote about George III, I think, does tell you something... about Sheffield's reputation. If you take the 1790s period, one of the historians who's done the most work on that period, Julian MacDonald, does think that a lot of the cutlers were literate, actually. And we know that copies of the Sheffield Register, Gale's newspaper, were bought for a whole workshop. So they would get a copy of the work, and perhaps the literate ones would read it out. Look, the French have won the Battle of whatever it is. Isn't that great? And they roast an ox they roasted an ox to celebrate a French victory. the French Revolutionary's victory in Sheffield, you see. That was quite something to happen, really. Very symbolic. So I think you can underestimate a lot of these cutlers are highly intelligent, bright people in quite kind of weak economic situations. And there was a lot of... there were huge numbers of alehouses, and they would exchange information in the alehouses.
Was there a Luddite type movement in Sheffield?
Not really, no, because I think the history is different. You see, there wasn't a weaving tradition in Sheffield, so the cutlery industry wasn't really industrialised. I mean, there may be industrial historians here. In my book, I said something like that a real industrial revolution didn't get going till the 1850s when these massive steelworks appeared. Instead, you got the gradual evolution of techniques of cutlery making, which was not as dramatic as what happened in the cotton and wool industries.
John, were you indicating? John Holstead?
No. I was just thinking there were no Luddites in Sheffield because it was the wrong industry. I mean, that affected the finishing processes in the textile industries, either in the hosiery in the knitting frames or, of course, the shears. In the woolen industry, so it was either in Nottinghamshire or in West Yorkshire rather than in Sheffield. And the point about how the news got in, well, the stagecoaches were coming up from London every day, weren't they?
Yeah.
So the news travelled quite fast, and people travel around a hell of a lot more than you imagine, I think.
Yeah. Yes, and Gales had some technique for getting the news quickly. He didn't reveal quite what it was, but he was very proud of this and advertised that he could get the news quicker than any of the other newspapers.
Chap over under the pillar there.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear the whole Holbury story, and it sounded like a classic intelligence operation. Where there was a guy who had infiltrated, the guy from Rotherham, and they caught him just in time. And it's often used, and I think it's used today still, where there's a terrorist outrage, and then that's an excuse for the authorities to come in with extra force. It's an excuse to be able to get away with shooting things, to control people. It's just that's how that whole Holbury story struck me. I mean, I have been studying conspiracy theory. that does kind of rub off. But it definitely sounded like he was set up to fail, and then the whole thing was used as an excuse to crush the charges.
Yes, I have seen you. I'll call you, but I'm giving people opportunities that haven't already participated.
Could I just comment on that? Before, I mean, if you read the chapter in my book about the period between the 1790s and the period leading to Parliamentary Reform, you'll find that in the 1810s, after the Napoleonic War, there was a character called, with a wonderful name, Oliver the Spy,
and he fits in exactly into your description.
Not a very good spider.
No. he was a kind of agent provocateur. So that sort of thing did go on, and I'm in some ways impressed by the Machiavellian cunning of the Home Office at times, yes. But I don't think I've never heard anyone interpret the Holbury story in the way you were doing, and I think it was
Holbury was the guy from Rotherham, yeah. Possibly.
Well, he was
pushing him, giving him ideas, or why don't we have a violent insurrection?
I don't. Well, it could be, but I don't. I think he was more of a rather weak revolutionary who was probably intimidated by the police chief. Oh. But anyway.
I've lost it. Where am I now? Yes, now then.
Well, I don't claim to be a professional historian, but I do know that ever since the peasants revolt, the establishment has always been paranoid about the peasants revolting. Mm. And indeed, they don't need the barracks as the barracks anymore. Because as we go home tonight, the CCTV will have us all on television.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They'll know that we've been plotting tonight.
Yeah.
From the result of the discussion, I don't really see much sense of revolution.
Anyone else? John?
Just a very, very small point of information.
Sorry.
Where was the Tontine Inn?
It was down, I think, nearly opposite where the old town hall is, in the market area. Roughly that sort of area. Anybody know?
Haymarket. That's where Wilkinson's is now.
Yes.
Wilkinson's shop.
Right.
Mm. I'm sorry, I've got you down as FHM, yes. And I've gone past you for some reason.
Yeah. Blunkett and a few of us from the south, from the Socialist Republic of Yorkshire, eventually did achieve significant national power. As far as I can tell, didn't really use this in a way which early supporters would have hoped. But I mean, were they the first of your kind of troublemakers to achieve significant national power? And if there were early ones, to what extent did they kind of follow through with their initial radicalism?
It's a good question. In a way, we haven't produced, I don't think Sheffield has produced a prime minister. And I think Blunkett actually has got higher up the, what Disraeli called the slippery pole, the greasy pole, wasn't it, than anybody else. And it is a greasy pole, because there's a chap called A.V. Alexander, who was a Labour politician, who was, I think, First Lord of the Admiralty during the Second World War and after. There have been various, who I think remained probably fairly radical. I think he was a co-op man. Others may on the whole, the radicals that I've written about are not people who've actually then moved into power. They're people who've gone on complaining and moaning until their dying day.
You haven't mentioned Fletcher or the Fletchers. Have you any points to make on them?
The baking
firm.
Oh yes, communist. Yes, interesting communist family, who
very sort of idealistic communist, I think. And that's an interesting strand that I didn't fully research, really. But the two communists I wrote about are J.T. Murphy, who we've talked about, who actually repudiated communism later in his life and said it was like a rather misguided religion, he said. And the other one is Alan Eccleston, Vicar of Darnall, who was a very idealistic communist and sort of defended the Soviet state right through all sorts of crimes that took place there, and was a devoted member of the Communist Party. He and his wife attended meetings every week of the Communist Party, fitting in into his busy schedule as a vicar. And the Fletch, he would have presumably known the Fletchers, I expect.
One of the nice stories about the Fletchers is that the CP were producing a newsletter during the general strike, and they used to load it into the bakery van and drive it around the city to avoid getting picked up by the police. Dave.
You mentioned Carpenter and also Ironside, I think you said, were very involved with education. One of my interests is Clarion Ramblers, because I'm a walker, and G.H.B. Ward. Again, a cultural educational background. Was that a particularly strong movement in Sheffield? Because it just sounds to be, it was the cultural socialism, educational socialism, rather than revolutionary socialism.
Yes, I think it's terribly important, really. If you look at the progress made by the in terms of the development of the primary schools in the late Victorian period, I mean, it's quite astonishing, and the buildings are still there, aren't they? But that was the school board, and it was probably dominated by liberals rather than by socialists, but it was a huge sort of achievement. I think it does suggest there was a very strong feeling about the importance of education, and that affected the industrialists as well. Firth, who founded Firth College, I mean, the origins of Sheffield University owe a lot to Firth, who was one of the industrialists. I think there was a strong educational movement, and probably, you see, when going back to Ironside, when Ironside set up the Hall of Science, which was a adult educational institution, among other things, that provoked, I think, the setting up of the People's College by very inspired nonconformists, and the Church of England Educational Institute by the Anglican Church. They were probably worried that the Hall of Science was a godless institution, so they set up sort of rival godly institutions. But it was all part of a thrust towards education.
Thank you.
I'm sure this is showing great ignorance on my part, but what was the chart which gave the Chartists their name?
It was a charter of 6 points, payment of MPs, equal electoral districts, annual parliaments.
Universal suffrage.
It's in a footnote in my book, actually. Maybe. But there were 6 points that they wanted. What it boiled down to was that they... to enfranchise all adult males, and it was all turned down. But then it gradually happens in a succession of parliamentary reform bills in the subsequent decades.
Except annual parliaments.
Except annual parliaments, yes.
Anyone else? Yes.
Well, there was an interesting programme on the radio interviewing the children of what they called the firebrand 1980s Labour councillors, and they were talking about what it was like growing up, being the children of these people, and most of them just desperately wanted to be normal at school. But I knew Tony Tickle when his son was a baby, and it was amazing to hear this baby now talking with a deep man's voice. And obviously the demise of that kind of socialism, and he now lives in Russia. But we often don't think about what it's like for them.
On the David Blunkett issue, if I could give a conspiracy theorist friend here, I used to give David Blunkett lifts to Labour Party meetings in the late 1980s in my old Ford Escort. I'm convinced that he was abducted and replaced by somebody else.
That's gone too far.
Humanism supports alien abduction, right?
Mike.
I was thinking this connects with something I was thinking earlier when you said a lot of these people just sort of, what was the term you sort of petered out? They carried on
protesting and moaning.
They never really hit the sort of peak, did they? Maybe the answer is that where they did achieve any kind of real political power, it sucked them in the way that it does, and emasculates them because the power becomes more important than the ideals. We've seen plenty of people who've done that.
Yes.
But I was interested in that.
That's the triumph of materialism.
That's the good phrase. Yeah.
It's like power corrupts in every form.
Yes.
Yes. Well, yes, I mean, Edward Carpenter's really an interesting one in that respect. I mean, he was seen as a father figure of the Labour Party, and when he was, I think, 80, the whole cabinet of Ramsay MacDonald sent him a message of congratulation. They were in power at the time, and so they sort of related to him. But whether he saw them as really introducing the kind of socialism he wanted, I don't know. He would probably be more interested in what happened in the 1960s in the way of social emancipation sort of thing.
Was the D.H. Lawrence character named after his lover?
It's possible. I don't know.
Yes, Anne.
Speaking as a woman and as an incomer, I do find the idea of Sheffield radicals slowly sinking into grumpy old men strangely comforting. But one I am very familiar with.
Yeah. Right, on that note. I think I'm going to bring the meeting to a close. But we've got. Don't tell me. Not all of you. But I do have to say thank you to David, unless he's got any final points that he'd like to make. And also thank all of you for turning up this evening. It's been a miserable evening, but I think it's brightened up after we've experienced you lot. But we are the Sheffield Humanist Society, and like all such societies, we don't have a great deal of money. So we are going to conduct a collection to which we trust you will donate generously. And with that, can I ask for another round of applause, not only to David, but to yourselves for the contributions that you've made because that's what makes these meetings.